From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Will Luck carry the Colts to the Super Bowl, or will New England stand pats on their recent AFC dominance? Will the Seahawks return to their lofty Super Bowl perch, or will the Packers keep them earthbound? Ahead on Only a Game, a look at this weekend's NFL Conference Championship games. Also, calculating the market value of top college football teams, if there was a market value for them, and Charlie Pierce analyzes the week's sports news. Also ahead, skier Hannah Carney grapples with post-Olympic life, and climbers gather in Colorado for the annual festival and competition at one of the world's premier ice climbing venues.
We actually have a team of three ice farmers who work for the Array Ice Park, and they create the ice here in the park. They maintain it. When it snows, they're out here hosing off the ice. I mean, it is a labor of love to create this park.
Stay tuned. In the run-up to the NFL's conference championship weekend, New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady posted a photoshopped image on his Facebook page. In it, Brady rides on the back of the Indianapolis Colts logo. The Colts haven't offered much of a challenge to the Patriots for the past few years, but as Only a Game's Karen Given discovered this week, that circumstance could soon change.
On the day after his team won their spot in the AFC Championship, Colts head coach Chuck Pagano was in the mood to look back. 3 years ago, Pagano was a rookie coach working for a rookie GM and shepherding a rookie quarterback, Andrew Luck.
I was looking for the head coaching manual, you know, and there wasn't one on the desk.
But don't tell Pagano that it should have taken longer to bring the Colts back to the AFC Championship game.
Faith is believing in what you don't see or can't see. And the reward for believing is you'll get to see it. So we got a bunch of guys in this building that believe in what we're doing and believe in each other. And, I mean, if you can't speak it into existence, it'll never happen.
While the Colts have been going on faith for the past 3 years, the Patriots have been busy playing deep into the playoffs. This is their fourth consecutive AFC Championship game appearance and the team's ninth with Tom Brady as quarterback and Bill Belichick as head coach. But to hear Belichick tell it, experience doesn't give his team an advantage.
I mean, right now I don't really care about any of the other games. Last week, last year, 10 years ago, whatever it was. You know, all our focus is on the Colts. And we got to coach well, we got to play well. So that's our challenge.
Belichick said his team will have to play and coach their best game to advance, which is something he always says this time of the year. After losing in the last two AFC Championship games, the Patriots know better than to underestimate their opponent. But the overall feeling at Gillette this week was relaxed, even when a reporter asked Brady to explain his now infamous intensity.
My wife asked the same thing. She's... It's your problem. But I get pretty edgy. I would say it's like watching the games on Sunday. You watch the first game, like the Cowboys-Packers games, and it's kind of fun, you know. You get to watch the game, and then all of a sudden, you know, you watch the Denver game and Indy play, and as soon as that game ends, it's like, boom, the clock starts, and it's a race to see who can prepare the best.
The Patriots have outscored the Colts 144-66 in three wins since 2012. When these two teams met in November, Indianapolis couldn't stop the Patriots' running game, and New England won by 22 points. But that doesn't mean veteran defensive tackle Vince Wilfork is taking his preparations lightly.
Luck is probably one of the best quarterbacks in the game. He's a young stud. And you'll be seeing a lot more of him in his future. So it's going to take everything we have.
During his Wednesday press conference, Andrew Luck called Tom Brady and many of the Patriots starters studs. But Luck said the same thing about Denver Broncos quarterback Peyton Manning last week, right before the 38-year-old played one of the worst games of his postseason career. Luck may be a young stud playing in his first AFC championship, but he says that doesn't mean he's playing for an inexperienced team.
I think we're blessed to have great veteran leadership, guys that have been there, done that, and so helpful. And then I think a great group of young guys that are willing to listen and sort of open their ears, keep their mouths shut. And you know, that's what I did. I still do. Listen to them. When those guys talk, you better listen because they've been successful for a reason.
Bob Kravitz, sports columnist and commentator for WTHR in Indianapolis, says there's a reason the Colts are so relaxed this week, and it doesn't have a lot to do with confidence.
I think this is a team that's playing with house money, and they understand that. They're a team that has no pressure on them. Nobody expects them to emerge from this game and go to the Super Bowl. So I think they're pretty chill down there.
Kravitz knows it's not a choice that's going to make him popular in Indy, but he's picking the Patriots to advance. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
In the NFC, the defending Super Bowl champion Seattle Seahawks will host the 2011 champion Green Bay Packers. Joining me to preview that matchup is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Tyler Dunn. Tyler, NFL teams tend to struggle the year after they win the Super Bowl. In fact, head coach Pete Carroll's Seahawks are the first defending champion since the 2004 Patriots to make it back to the conference championship game. How have they managed to do that?
It starts first with that defense. I mean, there isn't another defense in the NFL that hits harder, that closes faster, and is as confident as these guys. I've been out here all week, and I tell you what, they just are so comfortable in their own skin. And it really starts with Pete Carroll. He wants these guys playing loose, wants them feeling loose, and wants them to be confident. I mean, they're the kind of team, the kind of defense that tells you, we're going to punch you in the mouth, and then they back it up.
In week one, the Seahawks beat the Packers 36-16. Green Bay quarterback Aaron Rodgers threw for just one touchdown, and he had an interception. Running back Eddie Lacy was held to just 34 yards. Why are they playing again?
I tell you what, it's a much different Packers team and a much different Seattle team than what you saw there at CenturyLink Field in week one. I think the reason that Green Bay made it back is, first, Aaron Rodgers, he tells everybody to relax, and then he backs it up. He has an MVP season. And you look at that game, they were so stagnant offensively. And since that day, they've got a lot more creative. And Eddie Lacy in that ground game really got rolling. I think for Green Bay to have a fighting chance in this game, it starts up front with that offensive line. You know, you saw that brawl against Dallas when they're kind of fighting after the play. That's just the kind of attitude that you have if you're going to get into this cage fight out here in Seattle.
In that week one game, Aaron Rodgers did not throw a single pass in the direction of star Seahawks cornerback Richard Sherman. Will Green Bay have to adjust their strategy this time?
They absolutely have to adjust, because you could see the effect that that had on the entire game, on that entire offensive approach, because when you avoid half the field, when you avoid Richard Sherman, that free safety Earl Thomas, he can tilt the other direction. He can take away things on that other side. So I know Sherman's the best in the game, and he's going to make you pay. But look, you're also a really good offense yourself. They have to dictate the action one way or another this time around.
As you pointed out in a January 9th column, the Packers' defense has a recent history of not playing up to its potential in the postseason. This year's team has added veteran linebacker Julius Peppers. Any indication the defense will step up this weekend?
You know, the Dallas game is a great way to start. They played a lot of weapons and found a way to get it done there. And it really does start with Julius Peppers. And you can still remember Tremont Williams, you know, after the season, when they lost to San Francisco a year ago, he was pretty blunt and said, look, we're a draft and develop team. That's great. But sometimes you need veterans. You need experience. When bad turned to worse in seasons past, they didn't always have that experience. Julius Peppers is a guy, I mean, when he talks, people listen.
Okay, prediction time. Who represents the NFC in the Super Bowl?
I really think it's going to be Seattle. And I like what Green Bay's done offensively since they last played. But Cam Chancellor, Richard Sherman, this secondary, they're not going to give Aaron Rodgers the passing windows that he's had these last three games. Let's go Seattle 33, Green Bay 20.
Tyler Dunn covers the Packers for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tyler, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You got it. Thanks so much for having me on, Bill.
How much is your favorite college football team worth? If you're a fan of Ohio State University, the recently crowned college football playoff champion, then you can say your squad is worth more than $1 billion. But what does that number mean when applied to a college sports program? The Wall Street Journal's Jared Diamond has written about the value of gridiron teams, and he joins me now. Jared, how was the value of the Ohio State football program determined?
Well, this is something that a professor in Indiana named Ryan Brewer has been doing for a long time. He actually did his dissertation on this topic, trying to figure out how much these college football programs would be worth if you could buy and sell them the way you would buy and sell professional teams. And this year, for the first time, Ohio State came up on top, as you said, over $1.1 billion. And that was before they just won the national championship game. So Today, who knows what it is? It's probably gone up a few million bucks just in the last couple of days.
So there is no practical consequence of where you happen to fall on the list, right?
No, not exactly. These teams can't be bought and sold. they're products of the NCAA. These are universities. But because they make so much money, they make as much money as a lot of professional franchises, it's interesting to see just where they stack up. And when you're talking about $1.1 billion, the Buffalo Bills, an NFL team, just sold for $1.4. So that's showing just how much Ohio State is worth. And when you think about it, you know, talking to this professor that did this research, in his mind, in the actual market, it's possible that these teams would even go for more. And in many ways, college fandom, that is a deeper rooted fandom than even pro sports in a lot of ways.
What are some of the other blue chippers in college football, at least in terms of revenue and overall value?
In intrinsic value, the number two right behind Ohio State this year was Michigan. And if you look up and down this list, it's largely what you'd expect, maybe not the exact order, but it's clear that being a program that's been consistently good on the field for a very long stretch of time and has a long history of successful alumni, they seem to be at the top of this list. You're just going down the top five: Ohio State, Michigan, Texas, Notre Dame, and Florida. These are teams that win and have huge fan bases. You look at Oregon, who was in the national championship game and has been good for a good while now, at least in recent history. They were only number 18. And that's largely because they don't have that institutional history that teams like Notre Dame have, who frankly didn't have a very good season this year and is still number four just because they are Notre Dame.
You say that the rise in the value of elite college football programs has been tied to the value of pro franchises. You used that a moment ago for means of comparison, but how is the connection established?
The fan base and the money involved in NCAA football is as big as it is in some pro sports. You can make an argument that after the NFL, college football is the second most popular sport in the United States. And as a result, these teams, they would go on the market for as much as a lot of these pro teams, just because of how much money is in college football. It's insane when you realize these are, in theory, amateur athletes. These are institutions of higher education. But this sport, college football, and this NCAA playoff that we just had for the first time, the amount of money in television and all this is just, it's beyond belief. And it puts a lot of pro sports to shame, everything but the NFL, really.
You can find a link to Jared Diamond's column, What's Your College Team Worth?, at onlyagame.org. Jared, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on Only a Game, are great NFL quarterbacks born or are they created by one of this country's quarterback gurus? But first, 100 years ago this coming Tuesday, in a federal courthouse in Chicago, Major League Baseball defended itself against the first of many antitrust lawsuits. The claims were brought by the upstart Federal League, and the case was heard by Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, the future commissioner of Major League Baseball. Nathaniel Groh is an assistant professor of legal studies at the University of Georgia, and he's the author of Baseball on Trial, The Origin of Baseball's Antitrust Exemption. Nathaniel, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
The Federal League's complaint against Major League Baseball was 92 pages long. I'm hoping you can sum up the important issues in, 30 seconds or less.
I'll try. Basically, the argument was the Federal League had been launching this challenge, trying to create a third major league alongside the American and National Leagues. And they argued that the American and National Leagues had effectively monopolized the industry, that the leagues had tied up basically all 10,000-plus professional caliber players in the country, making it impossible for any new league to come into existence and to challenge their supremacy. And so they said that under the federal antitrust laws, the Sherman Act, that this was an illegal monopoly and that this is something that the court should address by striking down the baseball monopoly and giving leagues like the Federal League a fair chance to compete.
Judge Landis was known as a trust buster for issuing a then-record $29 million judgment for anti-competitive practices against the Standard Oil Company, but he was also known as a great baseball fan. Did the Federal League's lawyers not take the latter into account when they brought their suit to Landis's court?
It's a really good question. The Federal League was based out of Chicago, where Judge Landis was located in. Throughout Chicago, he had this reputation of being a big-time baseball fan. He apparently was a particularly rowdy fan of the Chicago Cubs during their championship years back in the early 1900s. And so given Landis's stature in the community and the fact that the Federal League was largely based out of Chicago, I think that they probably knew about it. And if anything, they might have thought they would help them, that having a jurist who knew the system and understood the contract terms that they were going to be talking about, that might give him a little bit more insight into what they were challenging.
On the first day of the hearing, 10 bailiffs were required as 600 spectators crammed into a courtroom meant to accommodate only about 200. Did they see a good show?
I think they did, although I'm also a little bit biased, perhaps. The Federal League launched into its argument about how the major leagues had monopolized the industry. And in particular, they really focused on the effect that the baseball trust, as they called it, had on the average player. This reserve clause that was in place at the time where a player had to renew his contract with his team for the following year. The players didn't have any mobility, any freedom. And on the flip side, the teams could cut the player on 10 days' notice for any reason at all. So you have this weird situation where the player was bound for decades, potentially, and the team for no more than 10 days. And the Federal League really tried to emphasize the negative impact that that could have on professional ball players in the United States.
When the hearing ended, the press predicted that Judge Landis would issue his ruling in as little as 3 weeks. Did observers have similar views on who would be declared the winner?
People were a little bit unsure. Major League Baseball had argued that we're not actually bound by federal antitrust law because we aren't commerce and we're not interstate commerce, especially, and therefore the Sherman Act doesn't even apply to us in the first place. At the end of the trial, people were leaning towards the big question being, would Judge Landis find he had jurisdiction? And then if so, he would probably issue a limited ruling in the Federal League's favor, although not, you know, breaking up the entire Major League monopoly.
Landis delayed his ruling for more than a year, as it turned out, and then it was moot because by that time the Federal League had dissolved and most of its owners had been compensated by Major League Baseball. By all accounts, Landis wasn't having trouble deciding which way to rule, so why didn't he rule?
He determined that if he issued a ruling, that it would be so damaging to baseball and so damaging to the national pastime that both sides would end up losing, not just the American and National Leagues, but the Federal League would also come out a loser. And he determined that it was within his discretion to withhold a ruling that would injure the national pastime. And that, so therefore, he decided to sit on the case in the hopes that the parties would eventually resolve it themselves, which, of course, they did.
Given the challenge regarding the salaries of minor league ballplayers and the Oakland A's potential move, maybe this antitrust exemption is finally about to fall. What do you think?
People have been predicting that for a long time, and it hasn't fallen yet. I mean, we're more than 90 years into it, and it's still here. Now's an interesting time. I mean, usually baseball only has maybe one of these challenges every 10 years or so, and now there's the two you mentioned, plus a television case. So there's actually three different lawsuits going on, and I'd probably say that it's not going to be overturned anytime soon, but I wouldn't be surprised if the court did eventually decide to weigh in on one of these pending cases.
Nathaniel Groh has written a whole book on the origin of baseball's antitrust exemption. It's called Baseball on Trial. The author joined me from Athens, Georgia. Nathaniel, thanks for joining me.
Thanks again for having me.
Fans of the NBA's Washington Wizards have endured nearly four decades of team mismanagement, regular season irrelevance, and playoff failure in the rare instances when the Wizards have actually made the postseason. But the Wizards are exceeding expectations this season. They're flirting with the top spot in the NBA's Eastern Conference and casting a hopeful eye toward the playoffs. From the nation's capital, Only a Game's Gabe O'Connor has the story.
If you're on YouTube right now, stop watching adorable cat videos for a second and look up the 1978 NBA Finals. Watch the final minutes of the Washington Bullets Game 7 victory over the Seattle Supersonics. That right there is the best moment in the history of Washington, D.C. professional basketball. Washington Post columnist Dan Steinberg sums up the following 37 years.
Hapless, irrelevant, sad, you know, disastrous, every bad word that you could think of.
Since 1979, the Washington franchise has made it to the conference finals exactly zero times and only won three playoff series. Otherwise, it's been year after year of forgettable basketball. And predictably, the fans stayed away. It's not that people hated the team, they just didn't seem to care. In 1997, the team's former owner, the late Abe Pollin, changed the team's name from the Bullets, the one thing everyone liked, to the Wizards, which nobody seems to like. Even in the best of times, the team had a hard time selling tickets. And in the worst of times, the team had to get creative, says Steinberg.
For years, the Wizards were famous, back when they were the Bullets, for marketing opposing team stars, for like blatantly saying, come to our arena and see Patrick Ewing, come see Michael Jordan, come see Dominique Wilkins.
The Wizards' fortunes changed in 2010. John Wall was drafted number one overall out of Kentucky. It took a little patience, but in 4 years, he's become one of the best point guards in the Eastern Conference. 2 years after Wall arrived, the Wizards drafted Bradley Beal out of Florida. Beal was only 19 when he joined the team, but he quickly established himself as one of the best shooters in the NBA. The Wizards have more recently added veterans Marcin Gortat, Nene, and future Hall of Famer Paul Pierce. Last year, the Wizards overcame a 2-7 start to make a trip to the playoffs, the first in 5 years. They even beat the Bulls in the first round. So this year, for the first time in what seems like forever, there's an actual buzz surrounding the Wizards. Tuesday night, the Wizards hosted the defending champion San Antonio Spurs. Cal Wiedei runs the Wizards blog truthaboutit.net. Before the game, he said it was a chance for the Wizards to see how they stack up. It would also be really nice to end a really ugly streak.
You know, I'm sure John Wall, he's never beaten the Spurs. He's our reigning champions. A lot of these players, they're definitely thinking about how this franchise has lost 17 games in a row now to San Antonio.
Wizards fan Rasheem Rook was at the game just trying to keep his expectations in check.
So if they could keep a lead and hold a lead, then I would say to myself, okay, maybe they can go in the postseason and be consistent. But right now for regular season play, if they can hang with the Spurs, then I feel they can hang with anyone else in the league.
The Wizards did a lot more than hang with the Spurs. They won 101-93 in a game they led most of the way. Afterwards, in the Wizards locker room, 20-year-old Bradley Beal, trying to act like a craggy old vet, says it's no big deal.
Not really. I mean, that's another win in my opinion. But, I mean, at the same time, it does mean a lot because, I mean, that's a great team. And when they had your number for so long, especially for people who've been here previously before you, it means a lot. So I can definitely say it means a lot, but at the same time, we can't heckle on too much.
So just how far can the Wizards go? It seems almost kind of insane to think they could make it to the finals considering where they were just a couple of years ago. But with the Eastern Conference so wide open, the next great moment in Washington basketball history might be on something other than a grainy YouTube video. For Only a Game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Washington.
In his new book, The QB, The Making of Modern Quarterbacks, Bruce Feldman explores the process by which several mentors, some of them former quarterbacks, are trying to teach boys and young men how to play that position. These coaches, some of whom Feldman refers to as quarterback gurus, talk of quarterback architecture and quarterback soul as they work on building quarterbacks and then infusing them with the psychological qualities and character that will ensure their success. Bruce Feldman, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
One of the characters upon whom you concentrate is former NFL quarterback Trent Dilfer. Describe how he decided that after a career he describes as less than satisfactory, his mission has become building better quarterbacks.
Here's a guy who has spent over a decade in the NFL, won a Super Bowl, and is now one of ESPN's star commentators, but by his own admission, is haunted by his failures of life as an NFL quarterback and said a lot of the things that he was taught, even at the highest level in the NFL, were fundamentally wrong. You know, he's trying to walk young quarterbacks through so they don't make a lot of the same mistakes he did. I mean, Trent Dilfer had a funny line. I was with him in front of a group of top college quarterbacks, and he said, my initials are TD. It should be INT. And he said, because I basically threw as many interceptions as touchdowns in the NFL. Pretty much all this stuff he was taught was all negative thought. You know, don't throw an interception. Don't take a sack. Don't do this. Don't do that. And he said it was really counter to what he had been coached to do or fed when he was in college.
Trent Dilfer says that he and his associates are looking for, quote, dude qualities. What does that mean?
Dude quality means that you will be the guy no matter what, kind of a fighter pilot guy, and a guy who is in complete control and the guy everybody leans to. And so it's poise, it's presence, it's grit, it's toughness. And as a quarterback, that is job one. Find a way to get it done. Whether you have a great arm, a good arm, whether you can run or you can't, just find a way to get it done. And for Dilfer, he calls it, what's his DQ, dude qualities. And, you know, it's a lot of people around the sport have really picked up on it.
It's such a weird perversion of language because, you know, the dude abides. He cares that somebody has stolen his rug and he goes bowling and drinks Black Russians.
Maybe that is his homage. I mean, that is a classic. And I think there is something to what that means and what the respect factor and a cool factor. And I think that's the part that carries over. There's a cool factor about it.
You devote a chapter of your book to Tom House, who had a long and successful career as a major league pitcher, despite what he himself describes as limited ability. What does House bring to the process of developing quarterbacks?
House is a fascinating character. He is incredibly self-effacing. You would think he has no athletic ability at all, the way he talks about his career. He is one of the leading, if not the leading, biomechanics expert in all of sports. He was a successful pitching coach. He coached Nolan Ryan, Randy Johnson, a bunch of other greats, and really got on the front end of technology, where technology meets sports. And he was living in San Diego, and Cam Cameron, who was with the Chargers at the time, he said, you know, we got this young quarterback, Drew Brees. I would love to get Drew Brees with Tom House just to see what would happen. And Tom House really helped transform Drew Brees' career and turned him into a, you know, a perennial Pro Bowler and arguably a future Hall of Famer with what he did. Everything from changing Drew Brees' diet to changing the way he rests and recovers to also the mechanics of his body. And Drew Brees swears by Tom House. That's his guru. Well, he's also now become Tom Brady's guru in the last 5 years. He's kind of worked the business backwards in a way where Tom House had elite-level NFL quarterbacks. And now because word is getting out, now college quarterbacks are going, hey, I would love to work with this guy.
The programs you explored all claim to pay attention to character, discipline, and emotional intelligence, but Jameis Winston went through Trent Dilfer's program, and Johnny Manziel is another guy who allegedly has so-called dude qualities. How much did Dilfer's program and other programs actually care about how their quarterbacks behave off the field?
Well, I think they care. In regards to Manziel, you know, he won a Heisman Trophy by largely doing Johnny Manziel's stuff. He was never going to be Russell Wilson, who Russell Wilson is first guy in, last guy out. That was never Johnny Manziel. Johnny Manziel's whole thing was, hey, I got to be me because that's the only way, you know, I'm comfortable. And, you know, he's learning the hard way that, you know, that might not be good enough. With Jameis Winston, it's a different dynamic. Jameis Winston has some knucklehead tendencies that he has shown off the field. On the field, the system he plays in at Florida State and what he does, the throws he's expected to make, are exactly what the NFL hopes to see. The only thing I think people, and it's only, but it's a big thing, people worry about with Jameis Winston is, can you trust him? I mean, is he a con man?
That's sort of my point. I mean, these guys are it's the architecture of the quarterback. They're trying to build guys who will be great quarterbacks, and it wasn't knuckleheaded stuff that Jameis Winston did in Florida. It was criminal stuff. I mean, you know, you got to train a guy's arm, you got to train a guy's legs, but you also have to train a guy's conscience, if nothing else, you know, so that he doesn't get himself thrown out of the league and thrown in jail.
Yeah, I mean, look, the name that comes up the most when you ask NFL people about who does Jameis Winston remind you of, it's Ben Roethlisberger. Physically a big guy who can make a lot of plays and very athletic. Ben Roethlisberger also had significant off-field issues, and Jameis Winston is going to bring into the NFL significant baggage as well. And he's always said, you know, every time he screwed up, he said, I'm going to learn from my mistakes, but he keeps making them. So we'll see. He's going to be a very fascinating study for the NFL over the next, you know, 5 or 6 months before the draft, because from a football talent, skills standpoint, he has first pick in the draft ability. But from the baggage where you're talking about investing millions of dollars, he's going to give them a lot to be concerned about. And I think there's going to be stuff that's going to come up where I don't know if they're going to be red flags, but they're certainly going to trigger long discussions.
Bruce Feldman is the author of The QB, The Making of Modern Quarterbacks, and he spoke to me from NPR West. Bruce, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
If you'd like to learn more about the nation's assembly line of star quarterbacks, I've reviewed the QB for onlyagame.org, where you can also read an excerpt from the book. Coming up on Only a Game, climbing frozen waterfalls in Ouray, Colorado. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
How do you suppose they cheer for the high school football team in Ouray, Colorado?
As in Ouray.
Hooray, Ouray?
It sounds good to me.
Ram-a-lam-a ding-dong?
I am told, speaking of cheering, that there are two significant football games to transpire this weekend. Which teams will win them, thereby earning the opportunity to be part of this nation's most popular television program on February the 1st?
American football, too, Bill. Mm-hmm. I think that this is going to be the greatest victory for chalk since the last time I clapped the erasers in fifth grade. That is a really terrible piece of writing right there, and I hope people immortalize it on audio tape. Anyway, Seattle and the Patriots are going to play.
Okay. Roger Goodell has granted the Colts' request to place linebacker Josh McNary on the commissioner's exempt list after McNary was accused of rape and other serious charges. He pleaded not guilty this week. This is the first time a player has been put on the list under the NFL's new personal conduct policy. Does this move signal progress for the league?
It's the day of Jubilee, Bill. What can I tell you? No, I mean, I think it signals progress for teams who want these kind of problems off their hands and for the commissioner's office who wants their PR disaster off its hands.
Newly ensconced Buffalo Bills head coach Rex Ryan has announced that he intends to build a bully in Buffalo, and that is a triumph of alliteration. Any chance the Bills will also be triumphant on the field?
Well, he's already halfway there because Buffalo has a very young and very talented defense, which is exactly Rex Ryan's specialty. It's kind of a small room for him, though. I mean, he's going to be inundated by the national press for a while because he's good copy. But come next November or December, he's still going to be in Buffalo.
Nate Silver, that master prognosticator behind the statistics blog 538, has figured out that Eli Manning is, quote, the most clutch postseason quarterback of all time. So does this settle the NFL's most glamorous sibling rivalry?
No, not really, but it's an interesting point of discussion. He has performed admirably in the two times that the Giants have gotten to the Super Bowl. Particularly, he's performed admirably against the New England Patriots.
Charlie, since we last spoke, the Ohio State University Buckeyes upended the University of Oregon in the first college football championship game. Were you surprised the Buckeyes held the Ducks' normally high-flying offense to a measly 20 points?
No, and I'm really not surprised that they were able to run over the Oregon speed rather than power defense for 42. I don't know. I realize, Bill, that American football is not your specialty, but when your team is, like, bigger and stronger than the other guys, generally you win. Pushing people out of the way is a very good technique to winning national championships.
That championship game was a triumph for ESPN and also for folks in the furniture and dumpster businesses in Columbus, Ohio. Explain, please.
Well, they tore down the goalpost, even though they didn't have the game in Columbus, and they also set 89 fires. But ESPN got tremendous ratings. It was the most watched show in cable television history.
It took 19 days, but Tommy Caldwell and Kevin Jorgensen have free-climbed the world's biggest granite monolith, which is a rock formation known as the Dawn Wall on El Capitan in Yosemite, because it was there?
Yeah, this is an amazing. The free-climbing this thing, I mean, people who are familiar with the Star Trek series of movies will remember that Captain Kirk was attempting to free-climb El Capitan at the beginning of one of them. This is a remarkable thing, and apparently the first thing that goes when you're free-climbing the Dawn Wall of El Capitan is your fingertips. You have to take special care of your fingertips.
The Australian Open begins this week, Charlie, but at the Brisbane International Tennis Tournament last weekend, Roger Federer had what he termed a special day. How so? This guy's won 17 Grand Slam tournaments. What's the big deal about winning the Brisbane International?
He won his 1,000th match of his career, which makes him the only player besides Jimmy Connors and Yvonne Lendl to do that.
We spoke last week of the newest inductees in baseball's Hall of Fame. Next month, the National Soccer Hall of Fame will welcome the player who made not 100, not 200, not 300, but 352 appearances for the U.S. team. Name that record holder, please.
Christine Lilly.
Exactly right.
And terrific. And Bob Bradley is going to go in, too, who's a very nice man and was a pretty good U.S. national coach and did not get treated very well. So that's a good thing, too. But Christine Lilly, 352 caps, right? Is that the way we
say
it?
Exactly right.
Well, that's a lot of caps. That's
it
like
is indeed.
That's like that story of the monkey up in the tree who throws the hats.
No, it's not.
It's not at all.
It's like the story about the greatest soccer player the women's team
has like
ever
seen.
Well, it's like that, too. The Canadian Museum of History has acquired what they've described as the world's oldest known hockey stick, and it dates to the 1830s. How long before somebody in Flin Flon or Moose Jaw goes up in the attic and finds an older one?
Oh, I guarantee you, either that or there's one frozen in the ice in Rankin Inlet. But this is a terrific story. This Mark Presley guy bought the stick from a barbershop for $1,000 and has turned it over for $300,000 to the museum's National Collection Fund.
And finally, Charlie, the Phoenix Suns are planning to give fans a big foam hand in order to celebrate the excellence of Gerald Green, who's averaging a little over 13 points a game this season. But how will fans know that the foam hand was inspired by Mr. Green?
It only has four fingers on it, Bill, because that's all Gerald Green has on his dunking hand. He lost a finger actually dunking a basketball when he was young, and now he's got he's got the most unique foam finger in basketball history, and good for him.
And someday, somebody will haul it out of the attic, and it will be put into a museum somewhere.
That's right. It'll be in a barbershop.
Just like that old hockey stick.
On Cape Breton.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and of course he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
You've been an Olympic champion and a top competitor in a sport that hasn't set you up for life. What do you do when your career ends? That's the question New York Times reporter Karen Krause recently explored with Olympic freestyle skiing champion Hannah Carney. Karen Krause, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Hannah Carney, the subject of your story, will retire from competition in just a couple of months at the age of 28. She had been told many times, apparently, that having been an Olympic champion would set her up for life. Why hasn't it?
There really aren't that many Olympians who are able to maintain their sponsors and their place in the spotlight after their careers are finished. People look at the few who do, the Lindsey Vonns, the Michael Phelpses. Mm-hmm. That's really the exception, not the rule. It's really difficult for the skiers, especially. If you're Hannah, you can't even get a scholarship to compete in college. So while your peers are going to classes and figuring out what they want to do with the rest of their lives, you are singularly devoted to this pursuit of excellence in a sport that doesn't really translate into the working world in any quantitative sense. Now, as Hannah told me, she's facing the prospect of being 30 years old and entering the job market with 21, 22-year-olds. Meanwhile, the people her age are already in their second, third, or fourth jobs as they're climbing the career ladder.
Has she decided what she's going to try to do after she retires?
She does not really know what she wants to do with the rest of her life. She has interests for sure. She loves cooking. She loves food. She loves the idea of perhaps being a nutritionist or working in strength and conditioning, because she was telling me that all of the younger competitors on the U.S. national team sort of follow her around like little ducklings in the weight room saying, what do we do next, Hannah? What do we do? And so she was saying, maybe I could be a strength and conditioning coach. So she, in some ways, is mature beyond her years, and in some ways is less mature than her age would suggest.
Some of our listeners are going to say, hey, why should I feel sorry for Olympians? They've had a heck of a ride. They're still young and strong. Are those folks missing how challenging the transition from Olympian to uncelebrated citizen can be for some athletes?
I cover swimming quite extensively, and I look at Michael Phelps and the travails that he has had, and this is a perfect example of someone whose focus has been singularly on swimming success. Imagine what it's like to be 19 or 28 and feel in some respects as if your best days are behind you. I asked Hannah, is the challenge for you to build a life so that your obituary isn't one sentence? Hannah Carney, who won an Olympic gold medal at the 2010 Olympics, her challenge is how do I fill out the rest of that story?
Michael Phelps, of course, is not alone. Australia's greatest Olympian swimmer, Ian Thorpe, has battled depression and substance abuse. I wonder if Hannah Carney is better prepared than most for life after the medals because she's at least thought about it.
I think she definitely is, and I talked to other Olympians who said, I am not worried about Hannah Carney at all. She's going to be a success in whatever she does because she's at least recognizing the trap. So I think it's something worth considering for every elite athlete that, you know, as much as you feel invincible and feel as if this is going to be your life for as many years as you can imagine, there is going to be a time where you are going to have to reinvent yourself. Hopefully using the tools that are in your toolbox as a result of all these years spent in the pursuit of excellence.
Karen Krause's New York Times story is After Moguls Come Life's Bumps, and you can find a link to it at onlyagame.org. Karen, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Some of the world's best ice climbers descended last week on the small mountain town of Ouray, Colorado, to test their skills on ice-covered rock. Some of them have been coming to the annual Ouray Ice Festival since it began 20 years ago. Others have moved to this community just to climb in the city's ice park. Sadie Babbitts was at this year's festival and brings us this story about how ice has made the town what some call the Switzerland of America.
The ice found in Box Canyon outside Ouray makes those icicles growing off your gutters this winter look pretty paltry. There's a curtain of ice here in this deep gorge that hangs like melted candles off the rock. And it's here where some of the best climbers in the world, like Canadian Will Gadd, come to play and compete. Gadd clips his rope into screws that are already set in the ice and rock. Sharp metal crampons on his feet and ice picks in his hands help him move up what appears to be a frozen waterfall.
Will's looking super smooth and cruising the lower rock section, and I'm feeling really confident that he's going to give us a good show here.
Bill Witt is a judge at this year's festival. He holds a stopwatch as he watches Gadd swing out onto a massive rock face called the Mighty Aphrodite.
What we're looking for is basically who gets the highest, the fastest. Right now, the upper platform is kind of rebuffing a lot of people. They're getting to the diving board and getting kind of schooled and knocked off the route.
The diving board is a man-made climbing wall that juts out over Box Canyon. A horse skull with deer antlers attached dangles from the top. Gadd shakes out an arm before he moves onto the platform.
3 minutes.
3 minutes.
Gadd has 12 minutes to complete the route, but with a couple minutes left, Gadd falls off.
Yeah, that's even too much for his hands.
His rope, clipped into the rock, catches him, and for a few moments, he smiles, suspended safely above the canyon floor. Gadd's been coming to the festival off and on since it started 20 years ago as a way to show off the sport.
And then it's just grown and grown and grown, and now it's a real gathering of the outdoor sports world, and it's really a lot of fun to see this much energy and this much psych put into a sport.
Now there are dozens of gear vendors, competitions, and prize money for the winners. Thousands of people come here every year to check out the festival and the ice park. But when windsurfer-turned-climber Bill Witt moved to Ouray from Southern California in 1989 to ice climb, there wasn't much happening. The mines in the area were closing, and people were leaving Ouray. In 1991, Witt teamed up with local attorney Gary Wild to buy a hotel in Ouray. The winter was so quiet, Witt was lucky to have one room filled at his hotel. Witt and his business partner started thinking if they could make more ice in the canyon, then maybe people would come and stay in the hotel. Witt says Wild was skeptical.
It was like full-on Field of Dreams. Build it and they will come. And he's like, you're mental.
The two got permission to access private land in the canyon owned by Ouray Hydroelectric. They worked with the U.S. Forest Service to have access to the rest of the land. And the hydroelectric plant let Witt tap into a water pipe that runs along the canyon's rim to make ice.
We welded hose taps on, basically like you have on the side of your house to hook your garden hose to. We hooked those on, we're like, wow, we got water.
There was a lot of trial and error those early years of the ice park, a lot of frozen garden hoses being shoved into Witt's hotel hot tubs to unthaw. Then it was back to the canyon to grow more ice.
So, I mean, it was hysterical, but that was the start of ice farming in Ouray.
5 years ago, the city of Ouray bought 24 acres from the U.S. Forest Service that now make up most of the ice park. Water comes from the city to create more than 200 climbing routes in the park.
It's absolutely gorgeous and astonishing. And what makes it more amazing is when you really understand what goes into it.
This is Nicole Green. She moved here 18 years ago to climb. Now she's on the park's board of directors.
We actually have a team of three ice farmers who work for the Ouray Ice Park, and they create the ice here in the park. They maintain it. When it snows, they're out here hosing off the ice to maintain its integrity. I mean, it is a labor of love to create this park.
I see ice that's melting and dripping off. It just looks like that huge chunk of ice up there could just fall off at any moment.
Yeah, that's the thing about ice climbing is you're on this very ethereal thing that you've learned your whole life, that ice is not a stable structure. But really, when it adheres to the rock, it's surprising what you can do on it.
1 minute left, Angelica. 1 minute left, girl.
This is the first time world champion ice climber Angelica Rayner of Italy has competed at the Ouray Ice Festival. Rayner's climb was high enough to win the women's climb and come in second overall.
How's the ice here?
Very nice. I really like the ice park. I would like to have something at home like this.
Oh, duel.
Rainer actually skipped a World Cup competition to come to Uray. Just a few years ago, only four women came to compete. On the men's side, Will Gadd climbed the highest to win his competition. He says there's just something special about this festival.
Here, everybody's rooting for everybody. You know, you want everybody to have their absolute best run. And that vibe is strong here. It's a community gathering, a gathering of the sort of ice climbing tribe, and just a great place.
It's a place that those guiding the direction of the nonprofit Uray Ice Park hope to one day expand by adding more climbs in the canyon. The nearly $200,000 needed to keep the park open and free to everyone is raised through the festival each year. There's always a question whether the park will have enough money, but organizers say the money raised from this year's festival has exceeded expectations. For Only a Game, I'm Sadie Babbitts.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is James Trout. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our intern is Keely Flanagan. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week comes from one of the top competitors at the Uray Ice Festival. Oh my gosh, I guess it would stand to reason that one of the top climbers would be the abominable ice monster. Quick, somebody dump the ice bucket challenge on him. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.